From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. They voted, again, at no small personal risk and by the millions. And now it appears that Iraqi voters have approved a new democratic constitution, despite strong Sunni opposition. We'll know for sure as soon as Wednesday, when the millions of paper ballots are expected to have been counted. President Bush hailed strong voter turnout, saying it is, quote, in stark contrast to the attitude, the philosophy, and strategy of al-Qaeda and its terrorist friends and killers. And once again, the voting itself is inspiring. But does it make for peace, for unity, for a U.S. withdrawal? This hour On Point, looking through the fog of democracy in Iraq at the Constitution vote and what it means. You can join the conversation. How do you square the conflicting images of bullets, car bombs, and ballot boxes? And behind all the bloodshed, is Iraq drawing closer to peaceful democracy, to stability, or not? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now with the latest from Baghdad is Dan Murphy, correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Dan, what's the latest on results there?
Just a quick correction. I'm in Bakuba, which is about 50 miles north of Baghdad in Diyala province. The latest on results is, you know, quite clearly as expected. This thing is going to have passed. Turnout was, again, probably in the 70% range, 60 to 70% range nationally. But the big story is that we've had overwhelming Sunni rejection as far as we can tell. Of course, these are mostly educated guesses because there isn't really much good exit polling. But some results have been pouring in from some large Sunni provinces. In so many ways, this is what many people feared was the worst case. A constitution that passed, but over the heads of the already disaffected Sunni Arab minority, who, of course, their members fill the ranks of the insurgency here.
Dan, let me just ask you, of course, the provision was that if just three of Iraq's 18 provinces voted no, the constitution would be scuttled. They'd have to essentially begin again. We're reading that two provinces, Sunni-dominated provinces, have done that. If just one more had rejected it, it would be down, if not out. But you're saying it's that clear now that no other large Sunni population provinces are going to muster a no vote here.
Again, it wasn't just a no vote. It had to be a two-thirds no vote.
So right.
You had to have 66% and change against. And I don't think, with the exception of Anbar province, the Sunni Arabs had the demographics anywhere in the country. I'm in Diyala province right now, which was one of the, let's call them three and a half. There were three or four, depending on who you talk to, provinces, that it was believed that there might be a Sunni Arab majority in them. Nobody knows. There hasn't been a good census in Iraq for decades. But it's quite clear from what we can gather anecdotally that in the province, Mosul, which is the second or third largest city in Iraq in the north, which is largely Sunni Arab, is probably no more than half Sunni Arab. In Diyala, where I am right now, Sunnis probably make up 40% of the population, with the remainder split between Shiites and Kurds. And they just couldn't, you know, if every single Sunni Arab had gotten out and voted no in these places, I don't think they could have rejected it. But as it turns out, there was a pretty high Sunni Arab turnout compared to the first time, and they did come out and vote no. It just didn't count for a whole lot in the end.
Dan, what was the mood as voters went to the polls? There was a lot of excitement in January, certainly in the United States looking on. Was there a feeling of optimism, of fear, of sectarian determination? How would you describe it?
You know, I think all of those things, depending on who you spoke to and where you were located in the country, there was probably less glee and sort of joy in this vote than there was in January, and there's a couple of simple reasons for that. You know, first of all, in transitional situations, the first elections are always better attended and participated in than the second. And second of all, even though there are a lot of people that got out and voted for this in the Shiite and Kurdish communities, you know, things haven't been so great in the, you know, 9 or 10 months since January in Iraq. People feel like their leaders maybe should have been able to do more to bring the security situation under control. The economy is very bad. So I think it was a happy day for the supporters of this vote, but it was sort of much more muted than it was last time around.
If the formal count confirms that, in fact, the Constitution has passed, remind us of the next steps in the evolution of Iraq's government.
The next step will be December elections, which in many ways will be both much more important and much more interesting and also much more complicated. And they will be to elect a permanent parliament. The January election was sort of an interim parliament that was going to serve for this year through this process. And now we are going to see a real political fight. And if Scurry holds for that next vote, there will be much greater Sunni participation in this, and they will be a much bigger bloc in the real parliament than they are now. You know, if they're 15 to 25% of the population, they probably will get close to that number of seats, whereas today they have next to none. So that is something to watch, and that's where we'll begin to get a sign if there's any hope for compromise and peacemaking amongst the three main factions in Iraq, or if they're going to be quite obdurate and obstinate with one another, and the hardening and sectarian divisions we've seen over the past year is going to continue.
Washington, the White House, have been celebrating the turnout, at least so far, and anticipating a victory for the Constitution. Yet you say that this passage with a heavy Sunni rejection within the passage is seen by some as a worst-case scenario. How? Why?
Yeah, well, I heard your comments about what President Bush said at the beginning of the thing. He's quite right that, you know, al-Qaeda does not want people to participate in elections and does reject the whole thing. But, you know, foreign sort of jihadists probably only make up about 10% of the insurgency in Iraq. Most of them are Iraqi Sunni Arabs who are unhappy with the way things are going. Now, just because they voted no doesn't mean that people are going to put down their guns if they didn't get what they wanted. So I think that there's an overestimation that the simple act of participation is going to mean peace. Sunnis are afraid that they're going to become marginalized next to powerless citizens in their own country. And this will have done nothing to put those fears at ease. And unfortunately, those fears are what motivates support for the insurgency and participation for the insurgency and their population.
Dan Murphy in Bakuba, north of Baghdad, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, sir.
We turn now to New York, and Fuad Ajami, Director of Middle East Studies at the School for Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. Fuad Ajami, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
And to the University of Pennsylvania, where we're joined by Ian Lustig, Professor of Political Science there, author of Unsettled States, Disputed Lands. Ian Lustig, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Fuad Ajami, we talked to you after the vote in January. You were in a celebratory mood there in the months since. We have seen, of course, an awful lot of death and destruction in Iraq. Now there's another vote. Good turnout again. It looks like passage for the Constitution. Are you celebrating again? Is this real progress, false progress? How do you describe what's happening?
No, I am, Tom, I'm no surprise to you. I'm sticking with my story, as they say, and I've been to Iraq since we last talked. I went in April, and then I went and spent a fair amount of time in July, August.
Yep.
And I returned with the same buoyant spirit, and I think it was an amazing day, Saturday, this vote on the Constitution. There's even a Constitution envy, by the way, in other Arab lands. I have talked to Lebanese, I've talked to Syrians, I've talked to people from the Gulf who look at Iraq, this land drenched in sorrow, this land marked for brutality, now pointing the way, and these people voting. Everyone will vote, and I think it's the beginning of the salvation for the Sunni Arabs. I disagree with Dan Murphy, and we can talk about that down in the show. But I think it was an amazing day for the Iraqi people and the enthusiasm. I plugged into one talk show on Radio Sawa on this Arabic radio service, mm-hmm. and there were reporters in various Iraqi cities. There were people, men and women on the street, and the pride that Iraqis take in the fact that they have a constitution is something really just noble to behold.
And presumably, Fuad Ajami, that means that you think the Sunni population will be drawn into a democratic process here, a peaceful process, and not estranged and turned in even greater numbers to the insurgency after this vote.
Yes, I think that's the big question about the Sunni Arabs. Fundamentally, many Sunni Arabs believe Iraq is a stolen country that has been taken away from them. And fundamentally, the Sunni Arabs are unwilling even to accept that the brute logic of numbers. For example, many Sunni Arabs told me in July when I was there, they insisted on this, they stuck to that they are 42% of the population, when everyone knows that they are somewhere between 15 to 20% of the population. Mm. Slowly but surely, the Sunni Arabs are being invited into the political process, and many of them are coming in, and many of them are beginning to separate themselves from the foreign jihadists to whom they provide sanctuary and from the insurgents.
Ian Lustig, how do you see the vote this weekend and its meaning?
Well, sadly for Iraq, or at least for my own morale, I see things quite differently than Fuad does. I think that just like you can't say anything at all about the prognosis for our economy by watching the stock market on an hourly or daily basis, you can't tell what's the big picture in Iraq by watching what the news is today or tomorrow. We can see from what Fuad has said and what Mr. Murphy said that people on the ground have vastly different perceptions about even what specific things mean. The big picture is that celebrating today is more or less like celebrating who wins the shuffleboard tournament on the Titanic.
We're talking about a constitution. How can it be that insignificant?
Because, well, you spoke of the fog of democracy when you introduced the program, and you were, that's quite an evocative metaphor. Titanic set forth on its voyage in fog and didn't know that this iceberg, which in this case is American withdrawal from Iraq, that's the big question. What can happen in Iraq? What kind of regime can be established that could survive an American departure? And without looking at that question, we are really not sailing into an iceberg. It's sailing into an ice field with no thought about how to get through. And I don't see... there are various ways you could break Iraq apart, various ways to lead to that disaster, but and one of them leads through this particular constitution as a stage, and others lead through other stages, but the end is more or less the same. There is no plan for how the United States can get out and how a regime that emerges under our auspices could survive our departure.
And we look on from this distance and try and make sense of it all. Ian Lustig at the University of Pennsylvania, Fuad Ajami in New York, please stand by. We're talking about Iraq after the vote. You can join us. How do you judge the significance of the Constitution vote? Do you have any idea, looking on from America, of whether this is progress or just a weekend pause in an unfolding civil war? 1-800-423-8255 is our number. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking this hour at Iraq after the weekend's vote, asking exactly what's changed after an apparent thumbs up on a new constitution and many millions of Iraqis turning out to cast the votes toward that outcome. You can join our conversation. How do you square the conflicting images out of Iraq? Bullets, car bombs, and ballot boxes. Should President Bush again claim progress? And are you still holding a candle for a peaceful civil society emerging in Iraq? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've heard a couple of views already in this hour from Fuad Ajami at Johns Hopkins University. Another thumbs up. Since that the progress is on the march here, he talks of constitution envy across the Middle East of what's happening in Iraq. Ian Lustig, University of Pennsylvania, says, not so easy. This is shuffleboard on the deck of the Titanic. When the U.S. leaves, they're still going down. Let's get another view here. From Washington, we're joined by James Dobbins, Director of the International Security and Defense Policy Center at RAND Corporation. James Dobbins, thank you for being with us.
Pleasure.
Very early this year, even before the January 30th vote, you wrote that the Bush administration has already lost the war. Has your mind been changed by the January 30 turnout, by this weekend's turnout, by the apparent passage of an Iraqi constitution?
Well, what I said last year was that the war wasn't one that could be won by Americans, but it could still be won by moderate Iraqis, provided we moved rapidly enough to turn responsibility over to them and to support them in a leading role in it.
Is that happening? Is that what we see this weekend?
I remain quite worried, although I also am less certain than either of the last two speakers, both of whom seem to be certain either that the situation was going to get worse or it was going to get better. I think there's a significant chance that it could continue to deteriorate. I think a safe prediction would be a continued, slow, steady deterioration in the security situation. But I don't think it's inevitable. I think that we've seen that democracy can mobilize Iraqis, but democracy is not going to unite Iraqis. Elections are polarizing events, particularly in societies emerging from conflict. And it's going to take a combination of statesmanship, moderation, and skillful, subtle diplomacy and use of influence by the United States to steer this in the right direction. I'm not optimistic that it's going to work, but at this point, I'm not prepared to write it off.
Fuad Ajami, describe for us the path that you see whereby Sunnis get drawn further and further into the weave of this new arrangement and become willing participants, not insurgents. How does that work? You hear so much skepticism about it.
Well, Tom, I mean, I base some of this on just spending a fair amount of time with many, many Sunni Arab leaders. And behind closed doors, they sketch for you their life. They sketch for you their dilemma and their options.
But they overwhelmingly called for a no vote on this constitution. They don't seem to have prevailed with that, but that was the call.
Yes, but let's vary this. Let's shade it a bit. Mm-hmm. Because in fact, there is one Iraqi political party of Sunni Arabs, the Iraqi Islamic Party, which mm-hmm. came out for the constitution. There is another group, the Sunni Endowment, Al-Waqf al-Sunni, which also came out for the constitution. There is some division within the Sunni community, and there is also militancy in the open and moderation behind closed doors. This is the fact of life in the Arab world. What people say in a public space isn't what they tell you in private and behind closed doors.
But the car bombs are real. We've seen, and as we hear again and again, this is largely an indigenous, a domestic insurgency, not foreign fighters.
Yes.
Those are presumably Sunnis.
Yes, that's exactly right. They are presumably Sunni Arabs, and they back the insurgents, but they also are beginning to hedge their bets. They back the insurgents. They give sanctuary to the jihadists who come from Yemen and Saudi Arabia and Syria, but they're also beginning to reach out to the other parties in the country. One point I just want to make, the Sunni Arabs don't want to commit the mistake, and all of them will tell you that. They don't want to commit the mistake that the Shia Arabs committed in 1920 when they rebelled against the Brits mm-hmm. and paid dearly and heavily for it. The Sunni Arabs want into the political life of Iraq. What they have to accept that they now have to share the life of Iraq, that the hegemony, the dominion, are gone. That's the issue here.
Ian Lustig, how about it? A picture whereby Sunnis realize that resistance is a kind of political suicide for them, and therefore, slowly but surely, they will come into the fold here. Can you see that happening?
Well, one factor that hasn't been mentioned is that the overwhelming feeling in the Sunni Arab world at large, in Syria and Saudi Arabia and Egypt and the Gulf, that Iraq is being stolen, as it were, by the Shia, by the Kurds, by Iran. And that hinterland of support for Sunnis inside of Iraq to resist this process is a huge factor that will interfere with any effort, however well-intentioned, to try to keep the country unified.
Are you saying external Sunni pressure then?
That's right. There's this tremendous feeling of hostility toward the idea that the Shia are going to inherit all this oil wealth and the whip hand in what may remain of Iraq after Kurdistan leaves. I think Americans need to understand, we have a notion of a constitution and a constitutional process that leads us to see this in a certain way. And I think it's worth remembering that when our constitution was debated, it was moving from a very weak confederation that wasn't working because it was too disunited into a more unified
mm-hmm.
state.
Mm-hmm.
And when we voted on it, the rule was that if if three-quarters of the colonies approved it, only then would it go into effect.
Right.
But it would only go into effect in those nine colonies,
mm-hmm.
not in the ones that didn't approve it.
Mm-hmm. And not everybody signed on right away.
Right. Now, eventually they did, but mm-hmm. the rule was that you could opt out. Here we have a situation where that the colonies, as it were, the provinces that vote against it still must accept the Constitution. And ironically, those are the people who want to keep the country united. That really what this is a constitution moving toward a very, very weak center and the opportunity for the Kurds and the Shia to take the oil and set up their own virtually independent countries that can become independent or, in the Shia case, try to dominate part of the Sunni area.
Which voices in those communities have said they're all for. I want to bring one more voice into this conversation, if I may. Joining us today from Boston, Peter Galbraith, Senior Diplomatic Fellow at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation in Washington, former U.S. Ambassador to Croatia. Ambassador Galbraith, thank you for joining us.
Tom, good to be with you again.
You've been a strong champion of Kurdish interests here, and I think I see you welcoming the vote on the Constitution. Is that because you think it will lead to a peaceful, united future, or because it protects Kurds from all depredations and maybe breaks up the country?
I think it's a very realistic constitution. The constitution does not break up Iraq. The United States broke up Iraq in 2003 when it ousted Saddam Hussein, who was the latest in a series of Sunni Arab dictators, and when it destroyed the pillars of Sunni Arab rule, namely the army, the Ba'ath Party, the intelligence services.
So are you saying goodbye and good riddance to United Iraq?
Well, yes, I think there's an element of that, frankly. This was a country that was held together by force. In recent years, some of the cruelest, the greatest cruelty that you can imagine. You have among the Kurds unanimous desire for independence, and they've successfully run their own affairs. There's real prosperity and growth there. There's a moves toward democracy.
So what's
why
the scenario?
Would you want to change that?
Well, what is
they
the scenario?
To the south, that's fine too.
Well, describe then, Peter Gabbert, the scenario of these super autonomous regions that leads to peace, or does it lead to perpetual Sunni opposition supported by the wider Sunni world, right on down into Saudi Arabia, and therefore no peace for Iraq and no homecoming for American troops?
Let's make the first point, which is the alternative of trying to force a unified country, which is not desired, is not going to be a formula for peace. It never has been. There has been continual Kurdish and Shiite rebellion in Iraq. Now, I think it is possible to have a peaceful outcome under these circumstances. Of course, if other states interfere, it's going to be much more difficult. But the Sunni Arabs now have a choice. They can either go ahead and form their own federal region and cooperate with Kurdistan and a southern region or regions, or they can be dominated by the Shiites. Federalism, in fact, is a protection for the Sunni Arabs. My sense of there is an optimistic scenario, that is that each of these self-governing states will decide that it is in their interest to cooperate. And that's very much the sentiment among the Kurdish and Shiite leaders today. While they insisted on controlling a part of the oil revenues,
right,
because they understood that when oil had been controlled by the center, not only did all the development go to the Sunni Arab areas, but it was actually used to finance the destruction of Kurdistan and the war against the Shiites. That they were not going to allow again. But they were and are prepared to share the revenues, which is really the important issue. But if the Sunni Arab insurgency continues, and if the Sunni Arabs don't get with the program, then I think you're going to run a risk that these other parts will be less willing to cooperate, more intent on keeping their own resources, and greater problems. But at least today, there is an element of goodwill.
Peter Galbraith saying this is a process of getting real. It may mean more autonomy, but it's just getting real about what Iraq actually is and is not. I want to begin to bring our callers in. Amy's calling from Marshfield, Massachusetts. Hi, Amy. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I have to comment. I was horrified by the comment that the vote in Iraq was similar to moving deck chairs. People risk their lives to go out and vote. We have to respect that. I couldn't believe that your guest said that.
Let's go straight to it. Ian Lustig, it's your metaphor, shuffleboard on the Titanic. Amy doesn't like it just as a matter, as a descriptive matter. People risk their lives to cast these votes. Peter Galbraith says, no, this is getting real. The interests will be aligned. Everybody will see ultimately that within their autonomy they're going to have to share. And so there's light at the end of this tunnel. Ian?
I only wish that my metaphors were the most horrifying or anywhere near the most horrifying aspects of this whole mess in Iraq. I agree with Peter Galbraith that the root of the disintegration of Iraq lies in the American invasion, and that and the decisions to destroy the army and the infrastructure of the state, those decisions have created a situation in which these macabre analogies and metaphors tragically apply. It's very common in the celebration of Americans at the end of terrorism when we invaded Baghdad is as uh, is in my mind, as phantasmagorical as the idea that a vote on this Constitution is going to save the country. Heroism at the personal level was involved both in our invasion and in the people who went to vote today. I don't question that. But we're in the business, or I'm in the business, of trying to take realistic long-term political assessments. And in that context, it's the ignoring of the iceberg looming ahead that is the decisive factor in our analysis.
But pick up Peter's line of thinking here. He says, acknowledging autonomy of these regions in a new constitution is realistic. It aligns reality with what's really going on in Iraq, and ultimately it will work out because it's in everyone's interest to cooperate. Can you see that, Ian?
Well, that's a very compelling portrayal, and it has, when it applies to the Kurds and it applies to the Shia, but there is no entity in Sunnistan. Sunnistan is emerging and will emerge in this context as a playground for the jihadists and a kind of permanent prison for American troops trying to hold together something that can't be held together, while in the march areas, in the areas that are mixed between Shia and Sunni and Kurds and Sunni, will have, I'm afraid, something that will look more like Bosnia than anything else as they sort those areas out. We have to think about the future in terms of what kinds of large-scale solutions are there that are possible for the United States. It's no sense to say, unfortunately, that, well, there's still a chance if the United States displays statesmanship, moderation, and subtle diplomacy. That's the problem. We have not been able to show any of that.
Fuad Ajami, what about Peter Galbraith's view of this, that in fact, indeed, as I read recently, James Glantz, the New York Times, saying this is a kind of divorce agreement in some sense. This Constitution lays a path toward greater autonomy, not integration in the center. You're optimistic. Does that mean that you see Sunnis accepting greater Kurdish and Shia autonomy and the share of oil revenues that are handed to them by those more populist powers, sects here?
I have tremendous sympathy and affinity with Peter because he and I have kicked around Iraq in the aftermath of this war and tried to understand what the Iraqis have been saying and doing and trying to do it up close and not speculate about it from afar. So I think we don't really disagree very much. I mean, my sense is of the Sunni Arabs fear that if the Kurds in the north leave this union and the south, and the Shia south leaves this union with the oil wealth of Basra and so on, that they would be left with a realm of gravel and sand. That really is their own fear, that they will lose. It's not so much losing Iraq, it's losing the oil money, which had been theirs. Tom, if you travel to Iraq and you see the size of the people in the south, they are smaller than the rest of the people in the
physically
country.
Smaller because they haven't had the oil money directed to them.
The terror inflicted on these people and the pauperization inflicted on them, their wealth was stolen, their dignity was stolen. As Ayatollah Sistani, in this remarkable meeting he granted me, said, you would never believe how the people were treated here.
And that's a path that the Sunnis clearly don't want to go down for themselves, and we hear that. I've got to say for a moment here, I'm sorry, Fawad, I'm Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. Peter Galbraith, I know we have you just for a couple more minutes here. Why would Sunnis accept that kind of potential exploitation that Fawad describes the Shia having suffered when Sunnis held power? What's going to bring them around to that? They know just how bad it can be. The Shias were physically smaller, Fawad's saying.
This is a problem, and it's always a problem when the people who were causing the repression no longer have the upper hand. But what is the solution? We can't go back and reinstall a Sunni Arab dictatorship. Incidentally, while I have a lot of enormous misgivings about how the United States has behaved since it entered Iraq, I think there was nothing. I think it was a good thing to get rid of the Sunni Arab dictatorship. I don't think that the kind of repression that Saddam Hussein and his predecessors inflicted on the Shiites and the Kurds was desirable or could keep for stability in the long term. I don't know whether this constitution will be the basis for a loose confederation or whether it will lead to a divorce agreement. But a divorce agreement is better than a unhappily married couple staying together and constantly fighting. And one of the things that this Constitution does is it resolves some of the issues that could lead to greater conflict, even war, among the communities. Specifically, it includes a formula for sharing oil revenues. It includes a procedure for resolving disputed territories. And it, by minimizing the advantage of being in power in Baghdad, it reduces the conflict for control over all of Iraq.
Ambassador Peter Galbraith, we hear that and we see your optimistic view of it. We thank you for joining us in this hour. Thanks very much,
Tom,
for being with us.
Good to be with you.
James Dobbins, Fawad Ajami, Ian Lustig, please stand by. Listeners, you can join us 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com, and Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about Iraq after the weekend's vote, the vote on the Constitution, the vote that apparently we'll know by midweek, we're told, means the new Constitution is approved. You can join the conversation. Does this vote mean that George W. Bush was right to say stay the course? Or is this another mission accomplished moment that will fade? And how do you count the ballots in Iraq and their meaning? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-3-TALK. We're joined this hour by Fawad Ajami from Johns Hopkins University, Ian Lustig, University of Pennsylvania, professor of political science there, author of Unsettled States, Disputed Lands. James Dobbins with the RAND Corporation is with us. After September 11th, he served as the Bush administration's special envoy for Afghanistan. He's co-author of America's Role in Nation Building from Germany to Iraq. Tom is calling from Woodbridge, Virginia. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Good morning. I would like to agree with the previous caller. I think the election is hugely significant. To have that many people turn out literally risking their lives is it's really unfathomable. I mean, in this country, we don't get turnouts like that if it rains. And I think what it clearly shows is that the people have the will to use the political process to solve their problems.
But, Tom, what if it means they're turning out to vote against each other? Kurds against Sunni, Shia against Sunni, Sunni against all.
They're still voting. They're still working it out without arms. They're working it out in the political process. And I think that's the key point, is that they have faith in that process. Otherwise, they wouldn't have risked their lives to vote.
Tom, we got it, and we thank you for your call. James Dobbins, how about it? You know the power of the simple image of voting to Americans is very strong. You can hear it in all of our callers so far this morning. They want to and do believe that when people turn out to vote, that means we're making progress. Are they wrong?
I think they could be wrong. I think in weak and conflicted states, elections are often a precursor to civil war. That's what we saw in Yugoslavia in the aftermath of the Cold War. The various regions in Yugoslavia were given the vote, and they voted to split up the country. And what you ended up was massive ethnic cleansing, genocide, civil war, and ultimately a large-scale international intervention. That's not to say it's necessarily going to happen in Iraq, but democracy alone is not a stabilizing factor in situations like this. Democracy has to be combined with other factors like power sharing among different communal and ethnic groups, like a respect for territorial integrity and sovereignty. And in particular, it has to be accompanied by a regional consensus in favor of the kind of regime that should emerge in Iraq. And in the absence of that regional consensus, neighbors are going to continue to pick Iraq apart, and it's going to be very difficult to preserve its territorial integrity.
And yet we want to believe that democracy will be so beguiling it can overcome the history of division and kind of forced cohabitation here. Mohammed's calling from Arlington, Virginia. Hi, Mohammed. You're on the air.
Hi. What amazes me about all the discussion is a total lack of the historical context. Iraq was a creation of Winston Churchill, and he had very clear reasons. He wanted to grab the oil for the Royal Navy, of which he was the far, you know, he created the British Petroleum to fuel the Royal Navy, to grandize the British Empire, and to create the links to India. He didn't care two hoots about the Iraqis. He
was, so we understand this long history. Exactly how do you see it playing in now, Mohammed?
Humpty Dumpty has fallen off the wall. It's just like Yugoslavia. The whole thing has collapsed. Iraq was held with brute force right from Churchill's time. He poison gassed the people there, bombed the people.
But we seem to have seen Iraqis forming a sense of a national whole. We've heard from many Iraqis on this show saying, don't break us into these sects. We understand Iraq as a nation no matter how it was created. And their people have interest in, I mean, the Sunnis need some of that oil, even if it's not in their sandy gravel patch.
Yes, there's a vested interest in the past three or four generations that was Iraq. But the thing, the fact is that you're having terrible civil war going on, massacres going on all the time, and that is an indication of where the deep forces are going. It's a breakup of that society, which is a creation of the British Empire.
And so there's the history, and that's that. Fuad Ajami, is history destined to be overcome here, or is Muhammad right that, you know, and sort of along Peter Galbraith's line as well, the lines are deep, they're old, they're not going to be overcome, the breakup is inevitable?
It's very sad to hear someone of the like of our previous caller speak of Iraq with such lack of disrespect. There is an Iraqi national identity. There are hundreds of thousands of people who call themselves, by the way, Sushi, half Sunni, half Shia, they're half Kurds, half Arabs. There is a proud and noble country. It has had a very sad history and a very cruel history. The state has been at war with the society, but it has great art, the great sculptors, great poets, and there is a great national tradition. And Tom, if you spend any time with the Iraqi leaders, the bonds between Talabani, the president, and Ahmed Shalabi, the Shia deputy prime minister, the bonds among the elites are very, very strong, and the determination of the Iraqis to see if they can pull a better history out of this cruelty is very noble and very strong. Everywhere you go, you see it, and everywhere you go, you feel it. And it's really sad when people speak of a society with such lack of disrespect. I can't share that. And, you know, I have been the recipient of the kindness of many Iraqis talk about their lives. The head of the Iraqi, the Constitutional Drafting Committee, Humam Hammoudi, is a friend of mine. And to hear him talk about the aspiration of this Constitutional Drafting Committee is ennobling. It's very moving.
But Fuad Ajami, those bombs are real. The deaths are real.
Absolutely.
The slaughter of innocent civilians is real. The centuries-old enmity between Shia and Sunni is very real. And as we've heard this morning, extends beyond the borders of Iraq. Are you kind of romantic for the power of that Iraqi nationalism? What's the fundamental thing that drives your optimism here?
No, let me take the issue of the Sunni Arabs beyond Iraq. I don't want to plug something I wrote, but I wrote a 3,000-word practically piece in the Wall Street Journal called Heart of Darkness.
Yes, we saw it,
About the complicity of the Sunni Arab world beyond Iraq with this insurgency. But the answer to that is not to give in to it. The answer is not to say, the regional states don't like it. The answer is to remind the Sunni Arabs, as I have tried, as many Iraqis have tried, to remind them that the fire that starts in Iraq will spread to their lands. And believe me, the Saudi rulers know that. I've talked to many of them. The Jordanian rulers know that. I have talked to many of them. So I don't think we should give in to this Sunni Arab bias. And it was kind of disheartening to hear Ian, for whom I have enormous respect, suddenly ennobles, you know, that we have to just acknowledge and obey and listen to and acquiesce in the Sunni Arab view of Iraq. The Sunni Arabs beyond Iraq have no right to determine Iraq's choices and Iraq's options.
Ayan Lostik, fight the power. Don't give in to that Sunni unhappiness and readiness to push back at a Shia-dominated Iraq. What about that?
Well, let me be clear, because I am not in favor. I wasn't in favor of the way Iraq was run before. I think it is a great thing that Saddam has gone, but not worth an American invasion, because ultimately he was on the way out. But the challenge was to build an Iraq, or to have an Iraq emerge that the Sunnis could be full partners in a way that would have a future for the country. That's clearly not available. I have three comments on what's just been said, quick ones. One is, the earlier caller, if he had looked at the election in the United States prior to the American Civil War, he might have been very impressed at the number of Americans voting, and therefore predicted that the bloodiest conflict in American history would not take place.
And yet it did.
Really. The second, to talk about, I'm afraid, Talabani's warm feelings toward Chalabi as some kind of genuineness about Iraqi national feelings is I think, misleading, especially when you take into account Talabani's recent call for the dismissal of the Shia prime minister from office, Jafari. And finally, I think we have to be, let's be very clear-eyed about this. If you start out, as Peter basically did, as a partisan of the Kurds, and you want a Kurdistan independent, and I don't have anything against that, then the American invasion was a messy necessity, and the Constitution that greases the skids toward legalizing that goal is a magnificent, or at least a relatively important step forward. And the same is true if you see the future of the Shia as want the future of the Shia to be dominant in Iraq and dominant in the South, then the same is true. A messy U.S. invasion that was necessary and a constitution that greases the skids right toward that outcome.
Yeah, and but those are
the United States with is holding this holding this absolute catastrophe in the center of the country with nothing to do with it.
But Fuad Ajami says, look, it's a catastrophe because the Sunnis aren't accepting it, and yet they could and should, and within Iraq they would. So stick with the side here, the United States. Don't give up on this. Resist the broader Sunni world. A, do you agree that that's the right American position? B, do you think it'll work?
The idea that we heard of the Sunnis have to get with the program sounds, I'm afraid, more like some kind of social activity on the Titanic than anything else. You have to offer the people who were the established elites in the country a real future. You have to arrange a deal, some kind of a working deal, where the leaders of the Kurds and the Shia and the Sunnis all believe they can get enough for one enough of the, what they need so that they'll accept what the other side is getting. This Constitution does not offer Sunni elites that deal.
James Dobbins, there's still room for negotiation. It's built in here, and especially after late conversations, 11th-hour conversations last week. Do you think that the Shia and Kurdish elites will ultimately give the Sunni what they need to be part of a bargain here?
I think it's still possible. I think it'll depend in part on what kind of signals they get from the United States, from other countries to whom they look for guidance and inspiration. I think a lot will depend on the conclusions the Sunnis draw from this experience. They went out to vote for the first time. They didn't succeed in blocking the Constitution. Do they come to the conclusion that voting just isn't worth it, that there just aren't enough of them to make a difference, and that therefore they ought to continue to reject the emerging arrangements and support the insurgency? Or on the other hand, do they go down the path which they seem to have started on, which is political participation? Do they vote in large numbers in the December election? Are they then represented by figures whom they respect in the new parliament? And is there pressure by the United States and others to accord the Sunnis a greater share of power than their pure voting numbers would justify? I think it's possible. It's still possible. It's still worth trying. But it's far from certain.
And there's that glimmer of hope for the moderate way. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Jeff is calling from Watertown, New York. Hi, Jeff. You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just have one or two comments. I was hoping you can build off of them. In my belief, and this is just my opinion, the Constitution was purely symbolic. I believe that the American people in general who believe otherwise are in denial if we believe that we're going to give Iraq true autonomy and, you know, in the, you know, as a sovereign state, if we really think we're going to give them the ability to nationalize what is their gross domestic product.
Well, you're saying the whole country is a shadow puppet of the United States? Is it the U.S.?
Assumed to be, regardless of the Constitution, regardless whether or not it lays the groundwork for a future civil war between the Shiites and the Sunnis and the Kurds, or what have you.
It's not a very popular war. Don't you think Washington would like to get out of there?
I think that it would, as far as the American public is concerned, but I still believe that we will never truly give them the autonomy of a true sovereign state, not so long as they're sitting on all of that oil. I hate to bring up a I know an over-talked subject, but I don't believe we'll truly give them autonomy.
There it is, an awful lot of oil. Jeff, thank you for your call. Ian, how about it? The real interests of the United States here, you hear Jeff. He says the U.S. doesn't want to leave, period.
Well, first of all, I want to welcome Jeff as a caller since I'm from Watertown, New York, and not
right.
many of us. So,
Homeboys unite.
I think it's ironic that what I think the United States is going to be left holding, Anbar province and the Sunni areas, are the parts of Iraq that don't have any oil, and that what we are effectively doing is arranging for the oil-rich parts of Iraq to be turned over to the Kurds, who may manage to hold on to it against Turkish and Iranian and Syrian pressure, and to turn the rest of it over to the Shia, who will have an Islamist state with very close ties to Iran. So it doesn't look to me that even if that was the motive of American policy, and I don't think it was, that we more or less have lost that game to begin with, and are going to end up, if we have anything at all, with what we would least want, namely the jihadi playground in Sunnistan.
Fawad Ajami, how about it? The United States inherits a playground of violence here, and and behind that, you're saying the conservative ruling regimes in the Sunni world have to see that their own interest doesn't go with this, but Al-Qaeda seems to want the upheaval here, and they're also Sunni.
Yes. Now, Tom, there is something very interesting, which has to do with the fact that the Iraqi constitution has already invested the oil of Iraq in the people of Iraq. This was a concession made to the Sunni Arabs.
What do you mean by that exactly? I mean
exactly, that the oil of Iraq belongs to the people of Iraq.
It well, it's a nice sentiment, but is that going to be so clear that it'll be equally apportioned, no matter who
absolutely.
Sits on top of it?
I'll make you a bet that the Sunni Arabs will always emerge with a higher percentage of the national power and the national wealth than the percentage of the population. Everyone is committed to this. Everyone is committed to keeping them in the union, in this government called Iraq. There will be a fair measure of decentralization, a fair measure of federalism. But the Shia are not running away with the country. And this business of Ian Lustig that the Shia are bent on establishing a Shia republic in Iraq, I don't know where he gets that. I spent time in Najaf with the great jurist of Najaf, and even the jurists, the Shia clerics of Najaf, don't want a theocracy. But this boogeyman that Bush created, a Shia republic in Iraq, is a kind of left-wing.
But we already hear those kind of reports coming out of Basra, people who oppose it being killed, a shadow sort of theocratic government within the police department
right.
there.
Tom, there is some anarchy, there is some disorder in the world of Basra. There are brigands in Basra. Mm. There is some chaos in Basra. But if anyone tells you that the Iraqis want a Shia theocracy, they know nothing about Iraq. And I also would like to ask Ian, I just have this distinct sense that Ian has never been in Iraq. Is that right? I mean, am I right? Because there's a truth that you know about Iraq. If you know the people of Iraq, for example, you say the Sunni Arabs are not represented. What does that make Ghazi Yawar, vice president of Iraq? What does that make Hajim Hassani, speaker of the National Assembly? I can name you one leader after another.
We hear the question. We know it's not entirely rhetorical. And still, we see the Sunni members of the insurgency. We're not going to solve this today, I'm afraid. With that, we're out of time, but it's been a good tour of the waterfront here, and I want to thank each of you for being with us. James Dobbins, terrific having you from Washington. Thank you
Pleasure.
So much for joining us today.
Pleasure.
Ian Lustig at the University of Pennsylvania, professor of political science there. Ian, we'll have you on again to answer Fawad's question, but thank you for being with us this hour.
I look forward to it.
And Fawad Ajami, good to have you as always. We hope that you're on to something here. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you for an excellent program, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.